The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You are listening to an RPA production, where people gather. Ladies and gentlemen, RPA is proud to present Aaron's Horror Show with Aaron Frail.
This is Jason Witter, author, illustrator of Tiny East Vampire and Monsters Eating Ice Cream, and you are listening to Aaron's Horror Show.
Welcome to Aaron's Horror Show. I'm your host, Aaron Frail. On Aaron's Horror Show, we're going to go ahead and read some horror fiction and talk about horror in all its forms, books, movies, you name it. If you want to go ahead and get a hold of the show, you can go ahead and contact Aaron's Horror Show at Gmail or Aaron Horror Show on Twitter or Aaron's Horror Show on Facebook. Thank you for listening and enjoy. Thank you for coming to Aaron's Horror Show, and I'm your host, Aaron Frail. I have a very special guest with me today. You know, I always thought it would be fun for you guys to hear from a film critic. I know I've interviewed a lot of filmmakers on the show, but I've never actually, you know, interviewed somebody from an audience perspective. So I have with me today Steve Silver. And Steve Silver is by profession an attorney, but he has always been a film buff for over 50 years, during which time he has usually seen some 200 to 300 movies a year. He has a library of over 3,000 movie titles on DVD or video. Steve also has some hands-on experience in the industry as well, having appeared as an extra in a Chuck Norris movie and a contestant on the network version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire with Regis Philbin, winning $32,000 for his efforts. He currently operates a website, www.silverscreenvideos.com, where he posts most of his reviews of all the current releases, and he is one of the top 2,000 reviewers on Amazon. All right, Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Aaron. I'm glad you had me. I just want to say this is my first podcast, so I may be a little bit nervous, so please bear with me.
Oh, that's okay. Everyone had to start somewhere. And, you know, our RPA listeners, you're on the Real Paranormal Activity Network. They are a great bunch of listeners. They're a very welcoming crowd. So they're definitely going to welcome you here today. So, yeah, you don't have anything to worry about. So I think I want to go ahead and start with your origin story. I always like to, you know, see where you came from. Was it a radioactive spider? Was it training with some ninjas on a mountaintop? You know, what made the Steve Silver of today? Where'd you come from?
Well, I an answer to both of those questions is no, but I started watching and following films at a very early age. In fact, I still remember some plots for some movies from back in the 1950s. And one of the things that really surprised me once I started watching movies on video and DVD would be to watch a vintage film from the 50s or 60s and realize that I still remembered a lot of the plot points from that movie. My parents would usually go to 2 to 3 movies a week, and once I got old enough to start going around myself, I would go to a number of them on my own, and when I went off to college, I attended Georgia Tech and then University of Florida Law School. I kept that up. Very often I would find places that would get me student pricing, and even after I wasn't a student anymore, they would take pity on me and let me in at cheaper prices, so help the budget along a bit. Along with the current movies, I got interested in the older films, the ones that some cases I had seen on TV, and in some cases just heard about and went to some of they used to have these retrospective theaters in big cities like Atlanta, and they would show usually a double feature, sometimes a triple feature, rotate two or three a week, and they would be on a similar theme, like you might in horror get, you know, three vintage Dracula movies, or you might get, you know, three Humphrey Bogart movies, or two or three. And you could go in, and a lot of times I'd spend 4 or 5 hours get my fill on that. Of course, once movies started coming out on video, those things pretty much went away, but I started collecting those. And for a while I had a business where I actually sold old movies on video and DVD. What I found out was that there actually was a market for that. A lot of movies would come out one time on a VHS and would go into video stores, and then they would never be released again because there wasn't really a demand in the general public for these older films. But I would find that they would be available, pawn shops, flea markets and so forth, and you could pick some of them up very cheaply and then get on places like eBay and find that people would pay, you know, $50 for a movie that I got for a dollar at a flea market. So
when I was back in college, a friend of mine and I, we used to go and buy books at flea markets, you know, or garage sales. We just, you know, here's a dollar, we'll take all the books you have. And most people would do it because they just want to get rid of them. And we would trade them in for store credit and find the ones that we know are collectible and put them up on eBay and get, you know, maybe $80 for a $5 investment. It was not a bad gig, but a lot of work in it, you know?
Yeah, it was. And I said, for a while I made money off of it, but you know, markets changed, and when went over from video to DVD, it pretty much blasted a big hole in what I was doing. Then obviously with the advent of streaming, everything just totally went away. So thing happened to me as happened to Blockbuster, except it wasn't quite as painful a lesson for me. And that's where my website began. Was I used that to market my merchandise on eBay and so forth. And then when that went away, I kept the domain name and gradually switched it over to the film reviews and articles and commentary, which unfortunately there's not as much of the latter categories as I would like, since I do still work full time, but I'm keeping going on updating and renovating the site. So
kind of talking about the site a little bit, you know, I've read your reviews, and I find your reviews to be really in depth and really just you look at everything about, you know, the film, and I really like your style because you really just leave no stone unturned. So when you review a movie, what's your process? How do you sit down and you know, write what I call an epic review of a film? Because, you know, you see a lot of people when they're reviewing, they maybe give it a paragraph or a couple sentences, but you really, you know, go into it and really get some nice, good detail.
Well, I do some background research on almost all the films. Yes, you know, I am familiar, but with them, but usually there's some things that I either don't know or have overlooked or forgotten, and bring up about the actors, the directors, so forth on that, and then try to lay out first a reasonably decent plot synopsis on these, and then kind of go into detail on what I liked and what I didn't like, and sometimes I'll go not so much on a movie itself, but on other films that this reminded me of, and how they came to be, and how this one was better or worse than the others. So it's not always strictly a review, but it's more of a commentary, and I try to aim at about 1,000 words on these, and usually keep them about that, which I think is enough to get things in depth without totally boring people.
Yeah, I mean that's a hefty amount of writing. You know, as a part-time writer myself, I know it can be tough to pump out 1,000 words, and it, you know, how do you do it? How do you keep up the pace that you go at?
Well, again, a lot of it is two things: is I think about it a lot before I write, and tend to write fairly quickly, and I spend a lot of late nights or early mornings, as the case may be, writing and revising. I've actually been a professional writer at one point, writing textbooks, and so I've got a fairly good background in grammar and style, so I don't need most of the time to do a lot of re-editing and things, and can go early.
Okay.
But it's just a matter of really discipline, and you have to sit down, and I think that's the biggest problem that all writers face is, saying, I'm going to sit down, and I face the same thing, that I'm actually going to start cranking things out and not go back and look at my Facebook page or look at the ball scores or look at the political forecasts and all these other things and kill a half an hour doing that. It's just a matter of really disciplining yourself and, one word, one sentence, one paragraph after another.
Oh, yeah, no, I completely agree with that. Whenever I sit down and write, I have a minimum point that I want to do every day, and I just make sure that I keep that up daily, because if I don't, that's when the Facebook and and the internet start to become they get in the way of that.
Yeah, and let me just make a statement about your writing is I know people who haven't may heard, but Aaron is one of the more inventive science fiction writers around, and he comes up with a heck of a lot of very interesting storylines, and I really think one of his most recent books, called Orion, which is somewhat similar to the Groundhog Day series of films about people reliving the same day over and over again until they get it right, is really a very good take on that. And anyone out there listening, I highly recommend Orion.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Actually, I'm reading a little bit of Orion here and there in this podcast, but I had started reading another book before Orion, so I want to finish that one, and then I'll kind of give the listeners Orion. But as I always tell folks, that I have most of my stuff on audiobook, so if they want to hear a much better actor than me, they can get that. But yeah, I appreciate it. I kind of want to find out, so you mentioned that you went to the old, movies, and you're talking, Dracula. I'm kind of curious about what your favorite monster movies of those old 50s movies are. Like what's, not just monster movies, but horror movies in general. Like, you don't necessarily have to say what your favorite one is, because, it's sometimes hard when someone puts you on the spot to pick a favorite. But, what are some good ones, some more memorable ones for you?
Well, I will tell you that I figure you might ask that, and I will say my two all-time favorite horror movies. One, a lot of people don't classify that as a horror movie, but I think it's in large part. One is Jaws, and the other is John Carpenter's The Thing. And
two very good movies, yeah.
And both of those I highly enjoy. And the thing about The Thing is, when I was growing up, one of the movies I did see was the 50s version of The Thing, which didn't strike me as being all that memorable. But we used to have something on Saturday afternoons called Theater X, which was cheesy horror movies from the 50s, and since we only had a black and white TV, they were all in black and white, and I guess most of them probably were anyway. And I watched those, and most of them were kind of laughable, but there were one that scared the daylights out of me, and I was probably 9 or 10 when I saw it, but gave me nightmares after that. Was one of the I later figured it out, because I started in the middle, was one of the versions of Donovan's Brain, which, for those people who are unaware, and it's been filmed under several different names, it's about a dead gangster who, from the grave, starts to take over another person, and when he takes over the other person, he wreaks revenge for people that wronged him. And there was one habit that the gangster had, that he would roll a coin around in his fingers in a particular manner. That was his, you know, nervous habit. And when the guy who's the hero of the story took over, was taken over, he started imitating the same thing. And what scared me was the fact that I honestly thought that someone might take me over and, you know, it would be some dead gangster or somebody, and I wouldn't be myself anymore. And that gave me nightmares for a long time. And movies that are based on things like that have always resonated with me. And that's one of the thing why it... the Carpenter version is so memorable, is because a large part of it is, are people people or are these something else? And throughout the whole movie, everybody is not sure who's human and who's not. And that just builds and builds and builds and really creeps people out, and it creeped me out. And then, of course, when the everything hits the fan and the special effects really start, it's very effective. And I have to say, you know, that one really, you know, even though I was a lot older when I saw it, it did get to me, and I thought it was very excellently done, and certainly one of the best horror films of all time. Jaws is one of probably my two favorites.
Yeah, wow. I don't think I've heard of Donovan's Brain. That sounds like a really interesting, intriguing movie. That actually, you know,
it was a novel, and it's been filmed a number of times. And the main version of it was I'm cheating here by looking it up, but it was a 1953 version with Lou Ayres. That may very well be the one that I saw. And there was an earlier version in the 40s that was under another name, which 1944 version, The Lady and the Monster, and that one was actually with Eric von Stroheim. I don't think that was the version I saw. I think I saw the Lou Ayres version. But you know, for a 50s horror movie, I thought those were, at least whichever one I saw, and I don't remember, it was pretty creepy.
Yeah, yeah. And let's switch to Jaws really quick, because I think one of the things that I read about Jaws that I find kind of intriguing was the fact that Spielberg didn't really have a whole lot of money making that film. And so a lot of the shots that we find most terrifying or most brilliant about the movie are just solutions that he was thinking of in the process of making that film, you know, like the point of view of the shark coming up against, you know, coming against the girl who's swimming in the water and only seeing a little bit of the shark and not the whole thing, you know, like a lot of those, you know, stuff that he made, I heard, was just because he didn't have the money.
Yeah, they didn't have the budget. They had a mechanical shark, and it didn't work right for a long time. So they had to shoot around it. And again, very often, especially in horror, what you don't see is scarier than what you do see. And Alfred Hitchcock told the famous story about, you know, if you show somebody placing a bomb someplace and the bomb blows up, wow, that's, you know, that's scary. That's not scary, but that's horrifying for a few seconds. But, you know, if you keep it there and you build the suspense, is it going to go off? Are people going to be there? Will someone stop it in time? You know, that's what really gets people on edge. It's the not knowing part, the not seeing part. And a lot of that happened in Jaws. And back when I saw Jaws in the theater for the first time, it was a different, again, era of movie making. I lived in Orlando, Florida, and there were a fairly small number of theaters in town. And Jaws was playing in one or two theaters. And it kept selling out and selling out and selling out. And finally, I went probably about 3 weeks into the run, and a matinee show, and wound up sitting in about the third row.
Oh, wow.
And that's how the kind of crowds you had back then, because you have a town where movies would only be playing at one or two theaters, and a good movie like Jaws, or, you know, would play for months on end. And I remember that the big horror moment, the first one, when Roy Scheider is chumming the fish and mumbling about, you know, how he doesn't like that, and all of a sudden the shark appears, that there was a very, very large woman sitting in the seat next to me, and the next thing I know, she's like in my seat. She jumped out of her seat. She was so scared of that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I had a similar experience, but it was this blind date that I was on, and you know, we went to dinner and we didn't really hit it off very well. Like, we had very little in common and not much to talk about. And I had even called a friend in the bathroom to like bail me out of it, but no one, you know, returned my call. So we ended up seeing Signs, the M. Night Shyamalan movie. And that's a scary movie. And she kept jumping, you know, into my seat, even though the date wasn't going very well. So it's a very kind of awkward situation, you know?
Well, this was a perfect stranger. This wasn't my date, so.
Oh. Yeah,
so it was,
yeah. It was even more awkward because you didn't really know the person that's suddenly on your line.
No, I didn't, but I got to know her more than I wanted to in about 2 seconds.
Yep, yeah. So, you know, I want to kind of, you know, so, you know, we are definitely, it's good we're talking about horror movies, but I also want to hear just more about some, you know, because you don't just do horror movies, you do pretty much any film. So go ahead and go through some of your favorites of all time, you know, maybe movies, maybe actors. Let's kind of hear what you really appreciate in film.
Well, I enjoy quality filmmaking, and obviously some of my favorites are some of the best, you know, about obviously things like Casablanca, The Godfather, and so forth. But I will tell you one, and is another one that didn't, you know, isn't at that level, but which really got to me because it surprised the daylights out of me. First time I saw it was Rosemary's Baby.
And oh, yes.
The reason why is that I'm sure if you've gone to any movie in the last 10 years, by the time you've seen the trailer, you know exactly what's going to happen because they give you in 3 minutes the entire movie. But back then, they didn't do that. Back then, there were a lot of what they called teasers, which literally were teasers, maybe 30 seconds or so, enough to supposedly pique your interest, tell you who was in it, who was the director, so forth, but not give anything away. And I had not read the book that it was based on. I knew nothing about it. All I know is there were posters which had a picture of a baby stroller, and it said, "Pray for Rosemary's Baby." And I knew that Mia Farrow had been Frank Sinatra's girlfriend. And I was under the impression that this was going to be some kind of melodrama about her having a kid or not having a kid or whatever. And it was an R-rated film, which at the time the R-rated films were kind of new and was usually promised some goodies in them for high school age kids who weren't used to seeing naked people on screen. So I said, wow, this is a great idea. And then I started into it and I said, what kind of movie is this? And it just totally, you know, blew me away that as it went on, and you know, it's just an excellently constructed film. And of course, Roman Polanski, who had his own share of legal difficulties after that, was at its best. But it's very hard to, you know, put a movie together that's done as well as that, and a large part of it. And I think that one of the things that people kind of miss out in horror movies is that some of the very good ones are actual really good mysteries. And it's not just some very large guy with an axe or a chainsaw chasing people around, but it's getting to the bottom of what's going on. You know, are there really ghosts there? Is somebody there not who he's or she is supposed to be? How does this work? And unraveling that is a large part of the suspense and what makes a film creepy. And with Rosemary's Baby, that was done extremely well.
Oh, yeah. No, that's totally what I appreciate is the mystery part of the film. I totally agree. Like, I think one of the intriguing things about a good horror movie is the fact that, you know, you don't see everything or don't understand everything all at once. You know, you don't, it's not as simple as they make it seem. Like one of the movies that I really like is The Ring. And I think one of the scariest moments in film for me is that scene where the girl kind of jumps out of the TV. And at the point that she does it, you think that the problem has already been taken care of, that the mystery has been solved, you know? So I think it makes it even more effective because you think it's over, but it's not, you know?
Oh, yeah. I think that the mystery angle is a large part of what makes, and, you know, even go back to the original Dracula, which, of course, by now there's no mystery to it. But, you know, part of it was, you know, figuring out who these people were. And, of course, obviously now we well know who they are. But back then, you know, what the main characters, the heroes, go through is an attempt to figure that out. And that's part of what makes it creepy.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. What did you think about the Francis Ford Coppola one that came out pretty recently with I think Harker was played by Keanu Reeves and Mina was Winona Ryder, I believe.
I think that Keanu Reeves makes a good Bill and Ted.
That's funny.
I'm still not sure which one he is, but he makes a good Bill and Ted. And I will say that, again, it's not one that's seen very often, but I think that the best version of Dracula on film that I've ever seen is the one in the late 70s with Frank Langella and Laurence Olivier. I think that's film version of Dracula.
What about?
Again, it's one that's not as common, but it's well worth seeking for people who are interested in that. And
what about
people don't realize back then was Frank Langella was a strikingly handsome actor back then, and one of the best looking actors around, even though he didn't do all that much work. So he was really one of the first actors playing Dracula who really captured the sex appeal of it way obviously Bela Lugosi never could.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting, because Bela Lugosi, I felt, was like a monster in a way. He was good at the monster, but I think, you know, when you talk about the sex appeal of vampires, I feel that that is why they endure, you know, like why we still get vampire movies cycling every couple years, you know, why you see Interview with a Vampire and then years later we get Twilight and stuff like that. It's never the sort of hideous fiend, but more the sexy vampire that people keep coming back to see, you know?
Oh yeah. And I read a lot of self-published fiction on Amazon, and the number of Twilight clones that are there are like number in the thousands. it's one of that, and zombies are just the most popular horror genres there, and you could probably read one of those a day for the next 10,000 years.
Oh yeah, if you like books with guys with abs on the cover, then you can find it on Amazon in abundance.
All right, that was Steve Silver. Steve, if you're listening, thank you so much for being on the show. And everyone, tune in next week for the second half of my interview. All right, so if you want more podcasts to listen to, we have Real Paranormal Activity with Aaron Hunter on Mondays. I'm on Tuesdays. Terry's Mysterious Moments with Terry from Texas is on Wednesdays. And then the Sandman's Lullaby with Patrick Sean Jones is usually on Thursdays. But it's a Phantom Cast, so you'll have to catch it whenever it appears. All right. Thank you so much for listening, and have a good night.